Tonight we're in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. It's one of the shorter chapters. It's really interesting because I have a chapter that's only 13 verses long. And so it won't be any problem covering tonight's. Last week we had chapter 7 and I had to rush to get through chapter 7. But chapter 8 is, again, real short. And the material here is substantial. I think it's significant. We'll see that in just a moment. Our text begins, "Now concerning." Now notice, "now concerning." What have we learned about that phrase, "now concerning"?
He's answering a question.
He's answering a question they gave him in a letter they sent him. And so he's answering one of their questions. "Now concerning things sacrificed to idols, we know that we have knowledge. We all have knowledge. Knowledge makes arrogant, but love edifies. If anyone supposes that he knows anything, he has not yet known as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by Him." Interesting language. Notice again the "now concerning." We are at the beginning of another answer to one of their questions. They've asked him a question, "What about meat offered to idols?" And we're going to see folks sort of in two different camps, and we'll talk about that as we get into the text. We all know that we all possess knowledge, maybe a quotation from some of the folks in the church that was in the letter. They said, "We all know," and I think what they knew is really true. They know that idols are nothing. And so the folks who are boasting about it say, "We all know that," and they're going to put down some other folks. And that's going to be part of the problem that we'll see in our text. But probably that's a quote. We've seen Paul frequently quote something they say and then respond to it. "It's good for a man not to touch a woman." That was a quote, and he responded to it. Food is for the body and the body for food. That was something they said, and he says, "Yes, but." And he's going to do this "yes, but" kind of thing frequently as we move our way through the book. The real problem is pride with those who have knowledge. If you know, you may think you're better than the folks who don't know. And these folks, I think, may be doing just that. We'll see that as we work our way through this chapter. If you think you really know something, that means you really don't. And that's really, isn't that a great way to respond? If you think you know, you don't. Again, folks who think they're so smart and have all of the answers are frequently deadly wrong. I've been enjoying that kind of thing, hearing some speakers recently who are rather proud about their ability. And a colleague and I went through one of the speeches we heard recently and picked out six things that were deadly wrong in one speech. And so it's really interesting that that kind of thing does happen. Folks boast about what they know.
And Paul's also pointing out to him previously that it's God that knows everything.
That's right. Yeah, and he's made a big deal of this difficulty of their knowing. They're boasting about their knowledge all the way through this book, boasting about their knowledge. And you'll remember that that's caused division, the division about who's their favorite preacher, as well as that kind of boastful pride. It's the opposite of the love he's going to compel them to have that he'll talk about the need for here. And again, we get to chapter 13, he's going to have a whole chapter on that and the need for it. What matters is not what you know, but that you're known by God. If God knows you, it doesn't make any difference what you know or you don't know. Now, I put a couple of pictures up here just to sort of point out some things to you. What you see on this this picture up at the top, that's the Acropolis. That's the place where all the prostitutes were supposed to have been at the top of that. And this is one of the little market stalls where they probably sold things like meat. And so I've put one of those, and I'll show you, there's another one closer up of one of those stalls where they would sell the meat. Folks would offer meat to their gods, and the way the priests would make money and pay their bills was they would then sell that meat they were kind of serving as butchers almost to sell the meat, okay? And so they're selling the meat to make money. But before they do it, they will offer it to their gods. And they make a big deal about it being offered to their gods. And some of them will do just that. Here are some more. You can see this one would have, each of those would have had an arch over the top of it, but all of those are things. This was taken, it looks like, on the trip I made in 2006. Therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there is no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is but one God and Father, from whom are all things. We exist for Him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through Him. Now, interesting language here. Paul says that we know that an idol is nothing. Those idols they have are, you know, they're just pieces of wood and stone and metal and clay. I mean, they're nothing. They have no power. They're nothing. And he makes a big deal of that. And this is reflecting on his good Jewish monotheism. There's only one God. And he may be playing off of something we call the Shema. Here it is in Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. That's the passage that every Jew would know by heart because they would say it at every single synagogue service. That's the way you begin every synagogue service. And to this day, they still do it. There's only one God, and they make a big deal of that, and it's Yahweh God. And notice the word Lord is in all caps there because that's God's name in the original language. The proclamation there is on God is typical of Paul's preaching to pagan audiences. When he talks to pagans, he will frequently say, you know, there are a lot of gods out there, but you've missed the one who really matters. You'll remember when he's in Athens, he will talk to the folks and he'll say, "There, I saw this idol to the unknown God." And that's right, you don't know the one who is the only one. And he'll make a big deal of that. So this is very common when he's preaching against their idolatry. Paul acknowledges the fact that believers do live in a world populated by so-called gods. One could walk through the streets of Roman Corinth and could not walk through the streets of Roman Corinth and deny the reality of the presence of the idols. If you go today, you will see at least two of those temples still standing, and there would have been a lot more than that. The only place I think there are more of them than I saw in Corinth was in Athens. In Athens, in fact, one of the early writers said that there are more gods in Athens than there are people. Because there's a god on every corner. And so they're all worshiping their gods. You couldn't deny the presence of these idols. The idols are going to be everywhere. In the polytheistic world of Paul's day, it was thought that the gods of Greece and Rome populated heaven and earth as well. They're everywhere. And so he makes a big deal of it. Some scholars have been a bit perplexed by Paul's language in 8:5. At the end of 8:5, he says, "Indeed, there are many gods and many lords." And so some want to say that he's somehow conceding the fact that there are other gods. I don't think that's the case. He's using that language almost to talk again about the so-called gods. The NIV translation tries to circumvent that by punctuating it appropriately with parentheses. Here's the NIV. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, end of, you see the two brackets there, as indeed there are many gods and many lords. And they even put the word gods in quotation mark and the word lords in quotation mark so that you'll know it's so-called ones. Paul's not admitting that there are many gods and many lords, but in the world in which he lives, folks consider there to be a lot of them. That makes sense? There are a lot of so-called ones, and he's making a big deal of that. He still has in mind the notion of those so-called gods that he used earlier in the verse. Paul has stated his explicit monotheistic belief back in verse 4. There is only one God. Fee's assessment of the meaning of 8:5 is helpful. He says, quote, "Paul does not intend to say by this that the gods exist objectively." He's not saying that they are really there or they are really anything. He affirms that there is one God, one Lord, who caused everything to come into being and to continue to exist. All right, verse 7. However, not all men have this knowledge. See, that's the knowledge some of them are boasting about. We know there are no gods. And here's what's going to happen. If you know that the idols are absolutely nothing, those idols are nothing, would you have any difficulty eating meat that had been offered to somebody, something that's nothing? See, if you have that kind of knowledge, you're going to say, well, they're not anything. And when they offer those sacrifices to the gods, to their gods, why, that's nothing. And so they have the knowledge, got it? That's the group with the knowledge. But some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Now, here's the picture. You got brothers and sisters who have been pagans, and they've now become Christians, but every time they think of that meat, they think of it being offered to the idol that it was offered to initially, before they bought it at the market. And so, if they eat that, their conscience is defiled. Paul will say, if it goes against your conscience, don't do it. Even if it's all right to do it, even if it's nothing that you do it, don't do it, because if you're breaking your conscience, you're destroying really who you are, and it's going to make you do all kinds of things that are wrong if you go against conscience. And he's going to make a big deal of that in our text. They're accustomed to the idol until now, eat the food as if it were sacrificed to an idol. Their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food will not commend us to God. We are neither worse if we do not eat, nor better if we do eat. And so he's going to make a big deal of that. He acknowledges that not everyone has this deep down knowledge. Not everybody knows. Some people are still accustomed to the idols, and when they think of it, they think of that meat being offered to that idol. Since their conscience is weak, it's defiled. He makes a big deal of that. It's at this juncture that the reader may be aware of how much there should have been a significant conflict between love and their monotheistic knowledge. You see, some folks just know this is the case, and so they say it's not a big deal. Why in the world can't you see that? Why don't you come here and just eat some of this meat with me? You see how they could really hurt their brothers and sisters by, they don't show love. And love is a big deal in this book. It's the opposite of the way they're behaving. They're not showing love. Love is, who do you put first? And they're putting themselves first and what they want first, and they're not really caring much about the brothers. It may sound surprising at first to hear Paul acknowledging that there are believers in Corinth who don't embrace fully monotheism. See, it might surprise you that the church at Corinth still has folks who are still struggling with the pagan background they had. They're still struggling with worship of idols, even though they believe Yahweh is God and there's only one God and Jesus is His Son, but that's still so much a part of their culture that they're struggling with it. Do we ever have folks like that in the church today who have come out of some terrible things but are still struggling with them? I think we do, don't we? You know, they've come out of that, but they're still struggling to get over it. Yes?
I was thinking, look at the Jews, how they struggled with Christianity.
Oh, yeah. Since food and eating of food is at the center issue, Paul must remind the offending monotheists that food does not bring one nearer to God. You're not closer to God if you eat it or if you don't eat it. He shows dietary matters or questions of freedom of diet are, spiritually speaking, matters of indifference. He makes this big deal. We are neither worse if we do not eat it, nor better if we do. If you don't eat meat because you're struggling with these things, you're not better off because you don't eat it. On the other hand, if you do eat it, you're not better off because you did eat it. It really doesn't make a difference. But take care that this liberty of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if someone sees you who have knowledge, dining in an idol's temple, will not his conscience, if it is weak, be strengthened to eat things sacrificed to idols? For through your knowledge, he who is weak is ruined, and the brother for whose sake Christ died. And so, by sinning against the brethren and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food causes my brother to stumble, I will never eat meat again, so that I will not cause my brother to stumble. Paul has already expressed his convictions about the superiority of love over knowledge. He'll come back to that again. We get to chapter 13. Love is what really matters, not these gifts that you think are such a big deal. The correct use of one's freedom will be based on more on what is the loving thing than solely on what is right. What is the loving thing? Well, it may be right that you could eat that because those idols are nothing, but he's really concerned about that. And he talks about their liberty. The word liberty here is really a word for freedom, power, right. It's their right. And it's related to this food offered to idols. And the idea here is of being a stumbling block, something that Paul will bring up in 8:9. I think it's really quite interesting the way he's used that he works through here. He says, first of all, now you got to remember that back in those days, if you were a part of a union, a guild, they would have called it a guild. You're a part of a union. The unions all hold their dinners in the temple. And so if you're going to be a part of the union, you got to go to the union meetings. And so you may go to the union meeting, and you go to the union meeting, and they're going to serve that meat that's been offered to that idol. And if you eat that, and you've got a brother who's a part of that union, and he still sees some significance to all of that, do you see how you're going to ruin him? You're going to ruin him. So you can't do that. And he makes a big deal of this stumbling block. And stumbling block is not what some folks have made of it. Some say, if it offends me, it's a stumbling block. No, it's not if it hurts your feeling. That's not a stumbling block. If it causes you to stumble, to fall, to lose your faith, to ruin you, then that's a big deal. Stumbling block doesn't refer to any practice or belief that just happens to offend another believer. A good example of that is eating in the church building. I don't know whether you've been through that. Most folks have been in churches where that's been a big deal. When I was preaching in Louisville, Kentucky, we had an older man and his wife who thought it was sinful to eat in the church building. And they just made a big deal of that. And they would say, "You're offending me when you do that." And I'd say, no, you don't understand. The word offend here doesn't mean that. Are we causing you to stumble? Are you going to eat in the church building even though you think it's wrong?" And they said, "No." I said, "Well, then we're not going to cause you to stumble, are we? Now, we're not going to cause you to do anything that's wrong. You're misunderstanding." And of course, he really thought that they were the strong ones and we're the weak ones. I mean, he wanted to flip it the other way around, the opposite of the way Paul is using it here. Again, by the way, eating in the church building really comes from something that we'll meet in chapter 11, where Paul will say about the Lord's Supper, "Don't you have homes in which to eat?" Now, you got to realize that they're also eating and having their fellowship meals in somebody's house, because they didn't have any church buildings in the first century.
They had a kitchen.
But they had to eat in somebody's house, because that's the only place that churches met. They didn't have church buildings. First church building is maybe as late as the 5th century, but no earlier than the 3rd century A.D., the 200s A.D. Could be 400s A.D. before we really get church buildings. Being a stumbling block is tantamount to destroying a person's relationship with God and causing that brother to fall into sin. You see that in verse 11 and verse 13. In a similar passage, in Romans chapter 14, verses 1 through 15 through 13, the strong and weak are divided based on their Jew-Gentile background. It's going to be interesting because in Romans 14 and 15, the strong and weak ones are, some are Jewish and some are Gentile, and the Gentile ones have come to see idols as nothing. They've become Christians now, and they say, oh, those idols are nothing. But the Jews, because of their background, the Jewish Christians, because of their background, are saying, oh, no, 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 no. God said, don't eat that meat offered to an idol. And so they're playing off of their Judaism. So it's a different issue, a slightly different issue in Romans than it is here. And that's important. Here the weak brother seeks to emulate the strong brother. The weak brother says, well, I guess if he can do it, I can do it. But all of the time he thinks it's wrong. And because of that, he's going to fall. It is in this verse that the weaker brother is led into sinful behavior on the basis of the exercise of freedom of the monotheistic fellow brother believer. It appears that Paul has no problem with a monotheistic Christian accepting an invitation to go to a meal in the home of a pagan friend. And I think Paul would have done that. I think if a pagan invited Paul to dinner, he would have gone to their house and he would have eaten whatever they served. Because for him, you know, idols are nothing. And if it's a pagan believer and I have a chance to win him to the Lord, I'll do that. But if I've got a brother who is with me and he is not so strong, I'm not going to eat any meat there. Because I care about my brother that much. And so it's really interesting. You see how he's trying to get them to appreciate their brothers and sisters. And that's sort of something that we've seen all the way through the book so far. They're not really doing that in terms of fighting over who's the best preacher and taking brother to court and all of the kind of things they've been doing. And so you see that the opposite of that is his appeal here. The problem arises when the Christian with a weak conscience has not fully embraced monotheism and sees these actions of a confident Christian and attempts to copy them. If he tries to do what you do, there's a major problem. And I think in our culture it might even be something like drinking a little wine with your meal. Is there absolutely anything wrong with drinking a little wine with your meal? Well, probably not. My brothers and sisters who are in Europe do that all the time because that's part of their culture. But if you do that and your brother has a problem with alcohol, he may do what you are doing and it may cause him to fall. And you can't do that. I think there are reasons for not drinking alcohol beyond that. I think there are medical reasons and all kinds of health reasons and the stupid things folks do when they do drink. there are all kinds of reasons not to drink. But in particular, you see how this call is to care about your brother and sister. Okay, let me stop there for a second, see if I've gotten you all stirred up here. You need to understand, if you're reading your Bible carefully, in the Old Testament, one thing that is forbidden is strong drink. And strong drink was anything other than wine, naturally fermented, which they would put three parts of water to one part of wine, which is going to dilute it a whole lot anyhow. But it's enough to make the water drinkable, because the water wasn't very drinkable. It's going to kill the germs in the water. But for us to argue, well, I can have a martini because Jesus turned water into wine. No, no. You've misread the text. You're misreading the Bible. Yeah. And you got another illustration?
We haven't mentioned yet.
And I think that's exactly right. I think you're hitting on the real key here. He wants them to be sensitive to their brothers. And being sensitive is, I mean, you hit right on it, I think. I think that's the whole issue here. Loving, if you love them, you'll be sensitive to them. You'll feel for them. You'll look out for them. You're going to want what's best for them. But that's a good... I think you hit it right on the head. That's it. Being sensitive. Okay. The brother will be emboldened to eat what was sacrificed to idols and therefore, because of his weakness in conscience, will in fact participate in an idolatrous activity. Paul encourages Christians to associate with pagan idolaters. Because if you don't associate with them, you can't win them. In fact, he makes a big deal back in chapter 5 when he said, when I told you don't associate with the sinner, I didn't mean folks in the world. Because folks in the world were all sinners, and if you don't associate with them, you're never going to win them. Jesus eats with tax collectors and sinners. So, he wouldn't have any difficulty with your associating with a pagan who is an idolater, but you got to be very careful that you don't, that doesn't rub off on you. Yes.
But he would be so-called.
Yeah, because that was a so-called brother who claimed to be a brother but wasn't behaving like one.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of destruction of the Christian is a sober thought for the Apostle Paul. He thinks that's very seriously. Paul is referring to eternal loss, not simply an internal falling apart. It's not that you're going to cause him to fall apart, but you're going to cause him to be lost. If you make him do something that he thinks is wrong, you're going to cause him to be lost. And that makes it deadly serious. The kind of blatant disregard for spiritual condition of a fellow believer is not just sinning against him. He says it's a sin against Christ. Christ himself. It's going to cause my brother to fall. If I eat meat, then I will be just a vegetarian. Now, we have a daughter who's a vegetarian, and I've kind of learned to appreciate vegetarian food. Now, she's not a vegetarian because she thinks that idols have anything, it has nothing to do with idols, but she just thinks it's the better healthy thing to do. We're better off living that way. And she was able to get her husband off of all kinds of medication and get his blood pressure where it ought to be and all kinds of things by their going vegetarian. And so when we go there, we eat vegetarian. And I've learned to eat vegetarian. But I still like my steak. I'm sorry, you know. And my pork chops and my bacon and, you know, all of those things I still like. And she's never going to convince me otherwise. I appreciate them. I enjoy them. And so far, they haven't hurt my health. And so that's not a big deal. But Paul says, if that's going to cause my brother to fall, I'm just going to eat vegetables. I won't eat any meat if it's going to cause him to fall. And maybe especially when I'm around him. Yes?
Just like with Paul's. How would you describe it?
I don't know, but among my friends who are Orthodox, they don't have any statues because they broke with the Roman Catholic Church over statues. So what they have are icons, but they pray to the icons. Well, if I'm going to pray to an icon, why not pray to a statue? You see, somehow that's missing the point, I think. I don't think they've seen the real significance of that. I collect the icons, by the way, because they're great art. And I have 50 of them hanging on my wall in my office. But you see, it's not a... For me, they're just pieces of art. But for them, they are something that they would pray to. And again, your Roman Catholic friends are going to pray to Mary. Because they'll pray to Mary, because Mary will ask Jesus, and Jesus will ask God, and then God will do what you want. But Mary has an inside track with her son. And so you're going to do that. So that's a part of it as well. Rosary was a way for you to count. You have all of those beads, and you're saying a prayer, and you do each one of those beads as you say your prayers. And once you get through all of those, you can get forgiveness. The priest will typically say, to be forgiven of your sin, you have to say X number of things, X number of prayers, to use your rosary. Yeah, yeah.
Mom was Catholic,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
why
yeah,
I said.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, yeah. I think Paul...
Respect that to the point.
Yeah.
And you've educated them and let them see.
Yeah, and I think Paul would have argued the same thing. I don't think Paul would have said, it's okay for them to keep thinking these things about idols. I mean, his goal would be to move them out of that and move them beyond that where it wouldn't be a problem for them. But as long as it is a problem for them, I got to care about them. But that's a good point. I don't think you leave them where they are. No, nobody does because they see mine as pieces of art. But it's primarily because if I had folks from Romania to come to my office and see my office, I probably would have to explain to them. So that they would see, so that they would understand that I collect them because I really like them. Although they probably wouldn't do it because I have so many of them. Because they don't do that. They've all got one or two in various places where they will pray. So it's not quite like my whole wall full of them. And it's a good question because it's the kind of thing that I might well find myself needing to respond to. I have a young lady who is from Greece, and when she came to my office, we talked about my icons and why I had collected them, but I made it very clear why I had collected them, and she appreciated that and understood that, so it wasn't really a problem for her. But that's a good. Well, what he's suggesting is that idol worship is what the devil wants done. And so in a very real way, when you're sacrificing to idols, you're sacrificing to the devil and his angels. So he sees the connection between idol worship and the devil. Because the devil, if he had his way, would have us worshiping idols all the time. And not recognizing God for who he is. Other comments or questions? This has been an interesting discussion after we've gone through all of that. So you've had good questions.